Welcome to another episode of the CBA's ABC's of Bow Hunting. I'm here with, I don't know if you're a Colorado native, you're a Colorado local, Lane Farris, who's a part of the Ultimate Predator Gear family, but also has a lot of hunting history and experience here in Colorado. And I'm excited to have you on the show today, Lane. How are you, man?
I'm doing great, Jake. And I appreciate the opportunity to come on and just shoot it with you. And looking forward to having a good conversation here.
Nice, man. That's exciting. Well, this is actually like the first time we've really spoke face to face. We may have been at the CBA banquet together or something before, but I'm curious, what's your history? Before we get into your hunting history, did you grow up in Colorado? Did you guys move to Colorado? How'd you find yourself here?
Yeah, so my dad moved here when he was in high school-ish, and I was born and raised here, Colorado Springs, Colorado, and went and played football at Falcon High School, went on, played college football at Western Colorado University in Gunnison, Colorado.
Nice.
So, and I don't really have any intentions of leaving. I love it here. Haven't ever seen myself anywhere else. So, and just too much hunting opportunity for us here. So
you mentioned Gunnison. So I'll have to ask, do you ski it or snowboard at all? I mean, going to college out there must've been an experience.
A little bit. So, yeah. I mean, I dabbled in it. I had a snowboard and all that stuff. And I had some buddies that really, really got into the snowboarding and the skiing scene. But right there in Gunnison, you've got Blue Mesa Reservoir. And that's the largest reservoir in the state of Colorado. And
oh, really?
It's got some monster fish in it. And so I was out there ice fishing more times than not.
Really?
In a pop-up hut and just getting after big lakers usually.
Nice.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. I mean, and I still love doing it. I'll go up there, you know, 2, 3, 4 times a winter, more if I can, and I'll go ice fish and all that. So
yeah, and just that area is in a wild place to explore. I don't know how much you were in the like hunting outdoors mindset when you were in college. I wasn't so much, but
too much.
Okay, too much. Just being in Gunnison,
I got into
you got some fun stuff to explore.
Oh, that area. I mean, you've got an unlimited amount of public land in every direction around Gunnison. You have some good over the counter elk hunting opportunities, not for archery, but for a couple of the rifle seasons. And as I told you, I was a football guy. So my elk hunting was kind of limited to rifle.
Ah.
I've never killed a deer with a rifle. I've shot one turkey with a shotgun, you know, so I'm bow hunter till the day I die, but because of football, I was always limited on elk. So
including high school,
to do,
like early days. Interesting.
Yep, including high school. And so like I was telling you, I was very focused on football and academics and all that stuff. But
he air quoted for those who were listening.
There was a little bit of e-scouting going on when I probably should have been watching game film or something like that. And it brought my coaches had some selective things to say about my focus at times because you'd be getting into that the dog days of the season, you know, week 8, week 9. And everybody's a little bit burnt out, especially at the beginning of my career, because we weren't that good of a football team.
Sure.
We were getting our butts kicked in. And so naturally my mind was starting to drift towards, I'm going to get a 4th season bull tag off of the leftover license list. And I'm going to go and hunt here, here, and here. And that got me into a bunch of trouble a lot of times, but, loved all of my time up there in Western. I was all over the hills up in there, you know, hunting, shed hunting, fishing, just whenever I could make it out,
It's a cool
place. 5 minutes out my door.
One of my best friends was in Crested Butte for like 4 or 5 years, and he left and he came back and we went on a little mountain biking trip back there. And I was like, oh, I got to come back here for elk. Like, this is going to be sick. But it's also real deal hunting out there. You're dealing with some real serious elevations. Like a lot of where I hunt is kind of sub 10,000 feet. And that's a little bit of a comfort level. And it's also where I've found elk. But out in Gunnison, man, you got some serious climbs, some serious elevation you're dealing with.
Just, you know, you're dealing with different terrain than, you know, a lot of the stuff that we have kind of closer to the front range, as soon as you cross over the Continental Divide, the landscape is just different over there. Mm-hmm. So you're dealing with, I mean, it's huge country, and you're dealing with a lot of sage. And then obviously, like, some of that stuff up near Crespi you were talking about, you're talking the collegiate peaks that, mm-hmm. I mean, they just jut straight up, and it's some of the prettiest stuff you've ever seen. But yeah, you can end up finding, and it's always fun to hear, you know, because I worked at a sporting goods store, I worked on a ranch, I work around all over the place in Gunnison, and hearing, oh, well, this guy that I know killed one at 7,800 feet, which is basically this elevation of Gunnison.
Uh-huh.
So really, really low,
yeah,
air quotes again, for that area. But then you might have a guy that went up and he killed his bull at 11,900, 12,000 feet, you know, above timberline. So it's just, there's a super large range of, you know, different kinds of habitat and where you can find the elk up in there.
Yeah, I'm kind of pivoting a little bit here, but I got to think, growing up in Colorado, training football in Colorado, training football in college in Colorado, you must have kind of came out of school in pretty decent shape in terms of being in the woods, being in the mountains, having some wind.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's funny because when I was in Western, I had a bunch, obviously all my best friends were on the football team, but I lived with a bunch of guys on the wrestling team. And I was always in good shape. That was one of the things that made me a good football player was, you know, having a motor that just go, 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 and not really, you know, letting my tired state of mind get to me. But I was never, because those wrestlers were just a different breed, because they were all more hunting and fishing oriented like I was, and a couple of pretty serious bow hunters on that team. And that's why, of course, we all gravitated together and started living together. But we'd go on a, you know, a second season rifle hunt, or, you know, just a hiking trip in the summer to go and fish a high mountain lake. And those guys had a motor. Those guys really had the gas tank. So good news is that I'm pretty darn useful when I got a heavy pack. But I don't know. I do okay in the woods.
I appreciate that answer too, because I think one thing I've noticed about myself out here is I'm not ever proud of being stronger than the next guy. I'm worried about not being as strong as the guy I'm looking at. You know, once you surpass even your old self, you're not like, oh, well, I'm stronger than I was a year ago. That's great. I still need to like 5X my endurance to continue to solo hunt, exactly, or increase the amount of hunting I'm doing.
It's always funny too, because, you know, you were talking about, you know, kind of getting into that like speed up the mountain thing, you know, and there's definitely a time for aggressive elk hunting or that aggressive stalk on your mule deer high country. And I've kind of got two different styles that I grew up with. You know, I grew up following my dad around the woods, and my dad is super aggressive. He's always an aggressive caller. He's always pedal to the metal. He wants to get to this spot. He wants to go, 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 and just cover as much ground as possible. And that's really any hunt. And then obviously once you get into elk, you're slowing down tremendously.
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, my other hunting role model was, you know, my grandpa. And my grandpa is very much the opposite. He's super slow, meticulous, absorbing everything, you know, because it's amazing when you're moving quickly, you're a little bit more tired, your mind is fatigued, mm-hmm. and you have the tendency to miss things.
Mm.
And so you've got that yin and yang type of thing. And I think it's super important to balance those two, because if you're flying up the mountain and you got to think, you know, I got to push harder, 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 you're bound to miss something. And a lot of times it's when we bump elk too.
Yeah.
But then again, you can't go super slow all the time, because you might not get your opportunity that way.
I really appreciate that juxtaposition. And I think being able to tap into both skill sets would really make a hunter come to that next level of when to be aggressive, when to be patient, and when to, you know, capitalize on a move. The thing I've realized is that like all of what we're doing is basically to create an opportunity. And then all of the practice that we do is to execute on that opportunity. So it's like a kind of a two stage. It's like the opportunity execution is all the prep and work and arrows and tuning and making sure your equipment's good, making that second nature. But creating the opportunity, that's where the intellect comes in, especially if you're solo hunting, or it doesn't even really matter if you're group hunting and you have a caller and a shooter or whatever your strategy is there. It's kind of a big two-part system. It's like, I need to create the opportunity. I need to execute on the opportunity.
Well, that's all about balance. That's all it is. I mean, and even like I was telling you before, I work at a pro shop for archery, and even, you know, just your, like your arrow build, you know, there's two fighting camps in, you know, how you should build an arrow. You know, there's the guys who want super heavy FOC and a heavy weighted arrow so that you get maximum penetration, your bow shoots quieter, etc. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, you've got the other camp that they want to go with as light of an arrow as possible, and because that thing's going to zip through the air, it's not going to drop hardly at all. Mm-hmm. And they're banking on the speed element of it, but it's all about balance again. Like if you're falling into one of those camps, that's great, you know, especially if you get, as long as you get your bow tuned correctly and you're practiced up, then knock yourself out. But you know, I've always kind of been a believer in that middle zone, because, mm-hmm. you know, that heavy arrow is great and it hits like a Mack truck. Mm-hmm. But if the elk can duck it at 40 yards, then I've got a problem with my arrow weight. You know, because imagine what it's going to do to that whitetail in eastern Colorado later in the season.
Right.
But then, you know, on the same line, you know, you can't have a 395 to 400 grain arrow, because then you don't have, you're not packing enough punch. And if you're dealing with penetration issues, what good does that arrow do you if you're just going to wound the animals you shoot at, as forgiving as that arrow may be?
Right.
So
I'm curious if you have a school of thought in terms of, do you use the same arrow setup? Like today you were going to go to Nebraska to hunt turkey. Do you use the same arrow on turkey, on deer, on elk, on everything? Or do you try to change and tune? Well, and
it's all about resource, because like, you know, for me, broke kid, now given, you know, I've got some connections out there and I've been able to do some really cool things in archery, in the archery world. But if I had the resources to where like I could build my perfect turkey arrow, my perfect elk arrow, and just build these different arrows for different animals, I'd do it. But I mean, as you know, arrows are not cheap anymore.
No.
They're not cheap at all. And so the only thing that I'll really change on my arrow setup is my broadhead. Mm-hmm. You know, there's certain broadheads that I'll use for, you know, turkeys and antelope. I like to use a mechanical head, like a Rage or a Sever, mm-hmm. Or a, you know, a Grim Reaper. Mm-hmm. Anything mechanical, because for a lot of those shots, I'm looking for a huge hole that you're creating. But on top of that, you know, with that mechanical head, you're taking away the blades, which act like airplane wings on your bow. Mm-hmm. Your tune becomes a little bit less important. It's still super important, but, your arrow isn't going to react as violently in the air, and it's going to fly more like a true field point, because you don't have major wings on the front of your arrow.
Right.
And you know, for antelope, your average shot is going to be longer than it would be on an elk.
Yeah.
So for a longer shot, I'd rather that arrow be flying just like my dang field points. And then when it gets there, a lot of the times, you know, with antelope, you're not going to suffer with penetration issues quite as bad as you would with an elk, because they're a smaller animal, a little bit softer animal. And so there's some scenarios like that where I like using a mechanical head. But then for, you know, whitetails, mule deer, elk, where I'm using my, and you know, it's like you said, I'm a part of the Ultimate Predator Gear family. I will probably be using a Stalker decoy until I die. Mm-hmm. That's how much that me and my dad and our family believes in that product. And it's just completely changed the game for us. Because as bow hunters, you know, obviously we like killing animals close. But doing it where you're deceiving that animal, and something about being able to trick an animal and to outplay them.
I think that's where the ultimate predator part comes in.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, because some of the things that I've been able to do with the elk and the deer, and then, you know, the deer I killed this year, turkeys, you're talking super close range. And at that point, in particular elk and deer, where you might have a penetration issue with the mechanical, because I mean, mechanicals, I kind of believe that they work 9 times out of 10.
Yeah.
Even with your best mechanical broadhead brands, because if you hit a shoulder, I mean, you might not even be okay with a fixed blade, but at least the fixed blade gives you a chance.
Mm-hmm.
But if I'm going to be shooting closer distances on animals where I need the penetration to 100% be there, I'm going to use that fixed head. And
with your fixed head, do you go 2-blade, 3-blade, single bevel?
So I'll tell you what, I'd love to use like an iron will or something like that. But dad's got some connections, and we've been shooting muzzy trocars. Muzzy trocars are probably the best flying broadhead that I've been able to test. And you know, I've kind of got two others that I throw in the mix. I don't personally use them now, but I've tested them and they fly great. You've got that the Grim Reaper Micro Hades Pro 3-blade.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Annihilator broadheads. I don't know if you've heard of them.
I've seen those. Yeah. They like shoot through car steel and stuff.
And the big thing is that you just hold that broadhead on one of its wings, and then you just slide it across a file, and you're able to resharpen your broadheads like that.
That's nice.
Which is a huge deal for, you know, guys who are major hunters, because broadheads, like everything else in archery, have gotten pretty darn expensive.
Yeah.
And so being able to reuse and recycle those guys is a huge deal. But those three in particular are the ones that I sell the most of, and that I believe fly the truest.
Interesting.
And so, I mean, it all comes down to your tune, having a good bow tech who's setting up your equipment correctly, but or doing it yourself, making sure you're doing it correctly. But that's kind of where I stand on the broadhead situation. That's really the only thing I'll change about my arrow setup.
I'm with you there. I started on the muzzy trocars. I started in Long Island, New York. It's a archery only area. And I was using, basically just kind of following Cameron Haynes, and I was using those trocars and I love them and they're great. And then moving out here, I kind of got into that iron will thing. And then that single bevel just really spoke to me. And last year I was using a single bevel, no bleeder. And that idea that it spins through the cavity of the body as it's going really like
proved
itself. Oh man. And so I'm kind of like a diehard in that realm now. I used a mechanical.
Bill
on a
and Marty
turkey.
Over there are they're awesome. Those guys are the men.
in
the broadhead industry right now.
They've got some really good products out there for sure. And day 6 is coming out with some similar stuff. I haven't tested any of it yet, but I hear Remy Warren talking about it all the time.
Yeah.
But we could talk about this forever. I'm sure this is also what your day job feels like, is broadhead tuning and all this stuff.
Oh,
but I want to get a little bit
I love
more.
My job, so
that's good. Well, I guess I can ask this. How did you get into tuning? Does your dad tune his own gear, or did you join the pro shop and start sweeping and then learn how to tune? Like, how do you get it's scary the idea of buying a bow press and doing your own thing?
Yeah. And well, you know, so a little bit of a backstory on my dad, as a lot of people already know, but there's some that don't. My dad's been in the hunting industry for a long time. You know, he started off at Inside Archery and had to have been like 2002 or 2003. When I was just a little kid, working there as, you know, a sales associate, selling ad space, and then finally got his big break with, you know, Mike Carney and Kurt Wells over at Bowhunter, working underneath of Jeff Waring as the associate publisher of that magazine. And eventually the producer of Bowhunter TV, and stayed with them for a long time for the majority of my childhood. And then I can't even remember now. 4 years ago, he ended up buying Ultimate Predator gear.
Oh, so it already existed. I didn't know
that. It had already, and this is the thing that it's like one of those things you kick yourself about, because we've got pictures from, oh gosh, the early 2000s, early to mid 2000s of a, another decoy company in the industry. My dad was using decoys for a long time. He's always been a decoy junkie, but he was very content with his position at these magazines and these publications, and wasn't really thinking about doing anything different. Well, one day he straps one of these decoys to his bow, cuts out a big hole in it, and he's like, this thing is going to kill birds. This thing is going to kill. And, you know, he started doing it with elk and all this kind of stuff. And he's like, man, somebody ought to do this.
So the decoy he was using, he modified and put that hole through the middle?
He modified it himself.
Brilliant.
And he was like, man, someone should do this. I can't wait for that day to happen. And then he goes about his regular life. And then finally, one down the road, you know, he sees this product, Ultimate Predator Gear, the stalker decoys. And he's just like, man, that was, whoever thought of that had a good idea. And, you know, but it was still something that he believed in, and he used them a bunch, and was like, man, I believe in this product. And he ended up buying the company, and it's been really good for him ever since. And, you know, we get to do a lot with those decoys. We still do a lot with Bowhunter TV. We've got a couple of hunts coming up. You know, my elk hunt last year is going to be on sometime this summer, June or July. We're going on a, me and dad are going on a, spring Montana turkey hunt, with the possibility of a bear getting thrown in there. So we get to do a ton of stuff with these decoys, and it's just, it's an incredibly fun way to hunt them. So
with that, well, the original, I want to get more down the decoy road, but the original question was about you learning how to tune and you learning how to build.
So obviously, dad being in the archery industry, it makes a lot of sense to learn how to operate the equipment that you're using, because that's not necessarily the case with everyone. I mean, you go on outdoor television today, and not everyone on those TV shows is tuning their own equipment and knows the ins and outs of how that piece of equipment works. And so dad's had a press ever since I can remember in a man cave. And I grew up watching him make adjustments on his bows, adjusting his cams, you know, center shot, just everything you can imagine for bows. And I always grew up as super interested in, you know, out of the, you know, four kids that my family has, you know, I probably took to it the deepest. And obviously, you know, now that's all I do for a living now. But when I got back I took a full year off of college during the COVID year.
Yeah.
And I went hunting from August 1st until December 31st.
Oh, what a dream.
I think my mom saw me like three or four times. and, you know, because I had saved up money over the summer and they had canceled my football season because of COVID. So I was like, well, I'm not
first time ever that you get to do this. Yeah.
I'm not going to stay in school. So I ended up, you know, dropping out temporarily, and I went and hunted my tail off, and it was one of the best years of my entire life.
That's awesome.
And by the end of that, I had spent all the money that I had saved, and I was like, oh man, I am very broke right now. I need to get some work here. And it just so happened that, you know, my dad had been friends with, Bill Pellegrino, for a long time. Bill's a, you know, a national champion archer, and owns this pro shop, Pellegrino's Archery Hut in Colorado Springs. And I went over there one day, and, you know, I've known Bill my entire life. I said, hey, Bill, I want to kind of broaden my horizons on archery, you know, because I was kind of in a little bit of a box because of, you know, like sponsorships and stuff like that. So the ability to, you know, shoot certain products, but I wanted to have a thorough, in-depth knowledge of how all bows work, what makes these products tick. And, you know, just to be exposed to all the accessories, all of the arrows. And so Bill hired me, and I started working on bows. And, you know, the more you do it, and especially working in a pro shop, because, you know, you're not just working on the Hoyt RX 7 Ultra. You're not working on the Matthews Phase 4. I mean, you're working with every darn near every bow ever created. I mean,
10-year-old, 20-year-old bows, all every brand, every
there's
string,
not a
every
lot
cable
of bows that I haven't at least seen in my hand, or had the pleasure of working on, or not the pleasure of working on, because there's some of them out there that are not fun to deal with. But yeah, and so I've been tuning bows in a bow shop for roughly a year and a half, 2 years now.
Nice.
And but been around it my entire life, so I've got a pretty good knowledge of how it all works and a bunch of opinions that are unwarranted about them.
And well, that's the whole point of going to the bow shop, is I'm planning on spending no money. Let me bullshit about arrow in front of center for 45 minutes and I'll leave with like $300 worth of fletchings and arrows and shafts and points. And every time, I'm up in Denver, I go to No Limits, and every time I'm like, oh, I just need a primer pen for A. And it's like $250 later and 45
Phil
minutes of bullshitting.
Phil is the man up there.
That's awesome, man. And I guess the thing that's interesting is, like, for me, tuning, especially broadhead tuning, but tuning in general, there's a point, I've only been shooting arrows for like 5 years, to get to the point where you're, I guess 6 years now, confident enough where you can make adjustments on your bow and you know it's not fully user error. That's a big thing. It's like, is it windy out? Am I shooting good? Is my shoulder tired? Mm-hmm. Should I even make a change right now? And then when you make those changes, oh no, I did it. I made it even worse, or I made it even better. Or, you know, there's minor changes like adjusting your sight. There's major changes like shimming your cams and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So it's, as a novice, if you will, like, I have a small set of tools I could work with to improve my arrow flight. With you, with a full shop, with all of the other knowledge of yourself and your colleagues, there's a lot more like avenues to get into danger, but also maybe other specific unique solutions, like a twist in the cable string or something that regular people might not do.
Yeah. And I mean, it's a elaborate science. I mean, because you, if you're, whatever the problem is, you know, there's a bunch of things that could be causing the thing and the issue. And, you know, more times than not, 9 times out of 10, it's not a problem with the equipment. A lot of the times it's us, because we're imperfect. If the bow was on a machine and allowed to shoot itself, it would hit the X 10 times out of 10.
Right.
So a lot of the times, you know, it is us, and it's things that we're doing. And, you know, as long as you stay consistent as a bow hunter, that's the number one thing. As long as you do it the exact same way every time, you'll get the exact same results.
Yeah.
And that's kind of where it's like, if you start changing things about yourself, you start falling apart, because, you know, it's doing something different every single time.
Yeah.
And, you know, going back, you know, you're talking about broadhead tune. And, you know, that can be a great tool for people, guys that aren't able to, you know, press their own bows or, you know, do any stuff like that. You know, being at a pro shop and, you know, being able to tune my own equipment and tune others' equipment, you know, I have a lot of methods about, you know, my general tune, that where if I am able to get my tune good enough, and, you know, good enough, my standard of perfection for my own setup is high. And it's almost unobtainable by just your regular customer coming in through the door, because, you know, my tune for myself, who's, I've been shooting a bow my entire life and do it professionally at a bow shop, it still takes me 4 hours. Mm. What is it going to take just the guy who shoots his bow on the weekend?
Yep.
But it's always been my stance that, you know, if I tune my bow correctly, that there shouldn't be a difference between my broadhead and my field points, no matter what broadhead I'm shooting. You name it.
Really?
I mean, obviously there's a lot that can affect that, you know, if the wind's blowing real hard, whatever the case is. But in theory, if your tune is good, your broadheads and your field points are going to hit the same. And with that said, I was talking to you earlier about how there's broadheads that fly well and there's broadheads that don't. That's not a stretch or an exaggeration. There's broadheads out there that fly really well. And there's broadheads out there that I wouldn't touch with a 10-foot pole. And, you know, I'm not going to name drop any of those, but I already name dropped you my three top ones that I think fly the absolute best.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's other, like, being able to understand the dynamics of, you know, okay, my, all of my arrows are hitting, you know, to the right of my field points. How do I need to adjust my rest in order to make that, to bridge that gap?
Right.
And so just having a knowledge of how to do those things is a very important deal as an archer.
Yeah.
So,
and having like a little bit of knowledge can get you into a lot of trouble. I'm sure you deal with guys who are like tried to get themselves in a good spot and made it even worse. And they're like, hey man, we got to get back to like foundations here.
And that's, it happens. I mean, shoot, there's times where you're working on your own rig and you're like, I don't know what I'm doing anymore. You know, you're so far down deep the rabbit hole. And, you know, a lot of the times, you know, it is just about getting back to the basics, getting back to the, you know, what's rule number one, what's rule number two. And because a lot of the times we get so deep, especially as we go down our archery journey, you know, how deep we get into it, we start to forget the very simple basics of like, okay, maybe I just need to move my sight to the right just a little bit.
Right.
You know what I mean? Something as simple as that. So and anchor points, all that kind of stuff. There's a lot of simple fixes as well and torque. But it's all, that's all kind of a fun, the fun part of the game is because it's not easy.
Yeah.
You know, no one does it because it's easy.
Right. It's fun. It's a challenge.
It's the hardest thing that you're going to do.
Well, one thing,
it's the biggest challenge.
One thing with that, that I really like, I got this from listening to Remy Warren a few months ago, was what he does is when his bow is tuned like perfectly, when he loves it and it's great, he takes photos of every piece of the bow and he calls it indexing. And that way, when he travels on a plane or gets somewhere and something's a little off, he could take a look and
see if something got bumped.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's pretty brilliant. And obviously like wet and hot and dry, hot and cold, those are factors. But one other tuning question before we get into more hunting stuff is,
yeah,
what amount of deviation in arrow weight do you think is acceptable? Let's say I'm shooting a 485 grain arrow, 2 grains in either direction, 5 grains in either direction. For you, is it like it has to be dead on nuts, or how strict do you feel? Let's say out to 60 yards.
It all depends, because if like, I can tell you right now, like I'm no slouch. I'm a pretty good shooter, but if my arrows were 5 grains off, which is that's pretty rough. That's not great.
Yeah.
You know, there's the only really people that I know that would be able to see the difference in arrows being that significantly different are, you know, like Bill Pellegrino and my dad.
Yeah.
Those are the ones that I personally have a great personal relationship with, that they're like, wow, that arrow is not right. Something's wrong with that arrow. And because, you know, that's another thing that people get kind of caught up in, because, you know, if they're not hitting, you know, a golf ball at 60 yards, they're like, oh man, like they kind of get down on themselves. Like, man, I'm not very good. Like, and they get into that negative mind space, you know. But the good thing about being a hunter instead of like, you know, like winning a tack tournament or something like that is that lungs are big.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, there's obviously you want to hone in your equipment as tight to spec as you can.
Yeah.
Because it is a big deal, but you know, not everyone can afford a $200, you know, dozen arrows with all of your, you know, a $300 worth of accessories on there, because in order for you to get arrows that are going to be within, you know, 0.5 grains of each other, you're going to have to spend money on a better quality. Get
that match grade. Yeah.
Yeah. And not everybody can afford that. And
I really like what you were saying about the elk lungs, or just vitals in general. Is one rule of thumb I like, I think I got this from Cam Haynes, is shooting at a minute of angle. So if I can have a 5-inch group at 50 yards, a 6-inch group at 60 yards, a 10-inch group at 100 yards. And now I'll be honest with you, like a 6-inch group at 60 yards is probably too, I'm a little stricter than that. Like in terms of when I'm
July,
August,
too.
if I'm not shooting like a fist size group, I will not shoot at the animal at that. But
well, that all goes back to just morals and ethics.
Sure.
You know, taking, because I was, I was talking to someone the other day and he was talking about, you know, his fixed pin sight that he's shooting. And, you know, he didn't understand. And I have no idea how this slipped through the cracks. But he didn't understand that you had to adjust the other pins on your sight, which is, you know, as a novice, if no one's ever told you,
you think it might, how just do you know? Work out.
And
of
this
box,
was an out of town guy that he was asking about a specific product to see if we had it. And we got into this elk hunting conversation. You know, he tells me that he takes a 70 yard shot on a bull last year and he didn't realize that, you know, he had to adjust his pins past 20 yards because he thought they were preset. And so it's like, you have a major issue there, you know, because that is a major ethical and moral dilemma.
And your like willingness to go out into the field with that lack of understanding of your equipment is a big one. But what I was kind of getting at was with that minute of angle training, if you think about an elk's lungs at about 16 inches, let's say, then if you can shoot dead center and aim dead center, you could be off 8 inches in any direction and still kill that thing. And so that's where I really think is like, for me, for my solo hunting, I'm like, if I am kind of at that 10 inch group, if I'm hitting a paper plate at 100, then I'll probably shoot elk out to about 60 and conditions being perfect, all the other caveats we need to throw in there. But it's always an interesting calculation, and it's a personal calculation, ethic, calmness, and then the ability to execute in that moment, that kind of going all the way back to that first thing we talked about is, all right, you created the opportunity. Do you have the nerves and the skill to execute on that opportunity?
And, you know, that's the thing is that everyone is at a different level in their archery journey. And like, I can tell you with confidence right now, like, I don't really believe that, you know, I know a ton of guys who are more than capable of shooting an animal at 100 plus yards, a ton that are, you know, they're terrific shooters. But in order for you to be able to live with yourself at night taking a shot like that, I mean, the conditions have to be perfect, everything down to the most minute details. And then, you know, but for me, I'm probably not going to take a 100-yard shot ever because I know what a turkey does to me when I see him strutting at 300 yards. I mean, like I have a very, I'm not one of those guys that can, that's cool as a cucumber, that can just has ice in their veins. Like I hear a gobble or I hear a bugle and all of a sudden, like I'm shaking a little bit, like I'm twitching. So, and yeah. And then on top of that, like my goal, it's kind of like, even like a rifle hunting example, it's like the long range guys, you know, like who are shooting deer, at, you know, 1,000 yards. Like if that's what, you know, if that's what your goal is and that's what you want to do and you have the capability to do it and the skill that it takes, because it takes a ton of skill, then, you know, awesome. I mean, I don't care how you get it done. You're hunting, you're enjoying the sport that we all love.
Right.
Like, go for it. But for me personally, like I don't, that 100-yard shot on a 380-inch bull, that doesn't do it for me. Like I'm looking for particular encounters, and scenarios. Like I would much rather shoot a bull at, you know, 5 yards because I want that encounter. Like it means more to me to be able to interact with that animal, you know, calling them in, and then being able to get in extremely tight on those animals.
That's fun of it. That's everything.
That's what does it for me. And, you know, but it's kind of like the reason why I'm more of a bow hunter than a rifle hunter.
Yeah.
Because where a rifle hunt ends is where a bow hunt begins. You know, because you take that 140-yard shot with a rifle, that's a drop in the bucket. And I know guys that can make 100-yard shots, 140-yard shots with bows.
Yeah. I really appreciate your mindset about this, because it's so easy to watch people on the internet judge everybody else on the internet who's putting stuff out there. Like I even put a video together of my kill this year and someone commented like, oh, it's obvious, like you're not ready for this. It's like, Have you ever hiked a mountain? Regardless of hunting, like, have you hiked a mountain? Like, I'm sweating. I'm tired. Like, is that your comment? Is that I was exhausted? And so it's just so easy to really, like, think that other people should be living your journey when really they're on their own. And my view is, if you're legal, if you're – it's hard. Ethics is a hard one to bring up because we all have that different standard. But if you're legal, then I don't have a ton of complaining. The only thing I have, like, a pet peeve with, and this is just a personal thing that I'm – not ashamed to, not necessarily call people out on, but let my opinion be known, is I think when you have a tag that gives you the right to wound an animal, if you kill it, God bless you, but it doesn't give you the right to wound two animals. A lot of people, like, I saw the guy, the elk, the deer, the whatever, the next day he looked healthy as a horse. It's like, you still stabbed the fucking thing. Now, I'm not putting my ethics onto you, but that's kind of where I'm at. And there's a difference, right, between an over-the-counter white-tailed deer hunt in Long Island where you could get 10 tags a season versus a 20-point, I drew this elk tag and I shot it in the ass and it's still running around. Like, I get that guy's value proposition is different on those, but to have that same level of ethics regardless of the situation, I think is really honorable. But and then again,
it all just depends, you know, because, you know, when I was a kid, I remember, you know, one of my earliest, you know, bow hunting memories, it was like a 40-yard shot on a bedded mule deer. Mm. And I had hit the buck low.
Yeah.
Okay. Because he was in his bed still. And it was the right situation. I was like 13 years old. I made a poor shot. And the arrow ended up hitting the deer in the leg. And, you know, it's like how you've seen deer that get hit by cars. And then you see them for the next 7 years.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They're extremely tough and resilient animals. Well, I was devastated by this, you know, because it's like when people ask you if you like killing animals, it's like no one ever really likes the killing part. Like, no, that's not,
I like eating it.
Yeah, I love eating it. That's the main reason we do it. And for the encounter and the hunt, the killing part is never what we enjoy. And you know, like that tore me up, you know, that I made a poor shot on that animal. You know what I mean? And I asked my dad, you know, like, where do we go from here? And, you know, the ethical thing, in my opinion, to do is obviously track that animal, see if you can get a follow-up shot, because now that one is, that's priority number one. Like, you can't go and shoot another deer until you either get another arrow into that deer or you identify that that deer is not mortally wounded.
Right.
And, you know, I was kind of like, man, I don't feel right about that. Well, the next day we're driving into that pasture to try to relocate him. Coyotes.
Whoa.
Coyotes.
Wow.
They ended up catching up with this deer and they took him down. And I mean, that's one of the most gut-wrenching things in the world. It's like, man, I made a bad shot and now that deer had to die and I didn't get to eat the meat.
Right.
You know what I mean? And the only thing you can do in situations like that is understand that, you know, those are all out of your control except for one thing, the shot.
Yep.
And so all you can strive for is to be better. I'm going to practice more. I am going to understand, you know, how my equipment works better. What can I improve on myself? What can I change about myself to make it to where I am ethical, to where I am making excellent shots? Because, you know, we can't change anything about anything else. All we can control is what we do personally to make ourselves better. And so I think as long as you are striving to be a steward of the land and to make ethical shots happen, then that's all you can really do. And, you know, mistakes happen, but as long as you're not one of the guys that's going out there and like, oh, that's a giant buck, I'm going to shoot him in the guts so that I know he dies.
Right.
Because center mass is the easiest place to hit on a deer.
Yeah. Not the easiest place to track, but I appreciate that perspective.
But he'll die.
Yeah.
So and
it's a tricky balance, but I do think that's kind of a big part of the personal journey too, is as you improve, as you have more experiences, good and bad, right? This isn't just an exponential growth chart. It might be, I'm getting better at archery. I'm taking longer shots. I'm taking more animals. And year five, I have a bad wounding experience and I kind of recalibrate and I like reset what I'm doing and how I'm doing it, and how I'm approaching it. That's unfortunate that it takes like real life experiences for that to happen, but Same thing. Last year, I took four animals and I was super confident. I felt great. The year before, I wounded and lost a turkey. I wounded and lost a grouse. I wounded and lost a white-tailed doe. And I was just like, should I even be hunting? And it's just those come to Jesus moments, which either you either put it down or you pick it up and you really hit the ground and you study and you make sure that you're making right choices out there. But I think that's one thing that I wasn't super exposed to prior to getting into hunting. And like, I'm a little mixed on the public knowledge of this, but like, there's a lot of wounding that happens. There's a lot of mistakes that happen. There's a lot of real life that comes into bow hunting. And I think that's a part of bow hunting that it's hard to talk about, but it's also a part of why we're there, is it's real, right? Getting on a train, getting on an airplane, logging on to online, being on Instagram, there's a fakeness to all of that, where when you're having that interaction at 6 yards with an elk or something, then there's nothing more primal, nothing more tapped in than that. And if it takes like a mistake for you to kind of level up, then that's part of the process. That's kind of how we got here.
And it all just comes back to that same point that we've been talking about, is just, you have to strive to be better. And that's, and you know, because like last year, you know, I filled every major tag that I had.
Hell yeah.
I was super pumped about that. I killed some really awesome animals and I was able to feed my grandparents. I fed my whole family. I fed my brother. I fed my best friend. I mean,
it's
like
a good feeling.
I mean, it's fantastic, but there's still things that I can improve on. There's ways that I can be a better hunter. You know, there's, you know, one of the deer I killed this year, I didn't make a great shot on the thing. He ended up expiring pretty quickly, but I was like, man, it was almost like you get a little lucky sometimes.
Sure.
And on that shot, I replayed it in my mind. It's like, man, I kind of lost my cool a little bit. I got excited and I let my brain run too much.
Yeah.
Where, you know, like, oh gosh, the deer's freaked out. I got to make the shot happen now. And then, you know, you lose your form, you get punchy with the trigger. And, you know, I ended up hitting him a little further back than I wanted to. I luckily ended up getting the back of the lungs.
Yeah.
But you just want to strive to be better. And that's all you can do. Just learn how to make better shots, practice your tail off. And as long as you're doing those things and that you're trying to be better, enjoy the sport that we love. I mean,
absolutely.
That's what
one
it all comes down to for me.
That you mentioned that I'm curious about, because you've mentioned it a few times now, is that you don't have ice in the blood. You don't have ice in your veins. You get excited about these things. And you've had a lot of experiences, whether it was following along with your dad or your grandpa, hunting yourself, hunting with friends. I'm curious, is there anything that you've come across to help with that, to help with the nerves, whether it's meditation, breathing, some sort of shot sequence, some sort of moment to pause to kind of calm you down there?
This is, you know, one of my most fun topics to talk about, because, you know, there's no iron set solution. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
You know, for me, it just comes down to, you know, even when I'm tuning a bow in the shop for a customer, like, it would be really easy because, you know, you're busy, you want to just get through it. I'm just going to shoot the shot and I'm going to go. And so a lot of times I have to think like, hey, slow down, because every shot is important. Every shot, you're building habits and you're building technique. And so you need to do it perfect every single time. Try to. And so, because really when it comes down to it, when that turkey is at 5 yards and he's marching towards my decoy, or that bull is staring me down at 30 yards and I'm at full draw and I can't let down, it's muscle memory. And because, you know, you're not really thinking at all, but my heart's pounding out of my chest. I sound like an asthmatic trying to breathe. And, you know, I tell people all the time, like, I don't necessarily want to fix that problem. And that sounds kind of weird because, you know, like, obviously you always want to fix the problem, but the day that I don't feel like that, I'll know that my fire for bow hunting has died. And honestly, I can't even imagine that day. I think it'd be the worst day of my life. Because I just, that's why I do it. That's why I love bow hunting, is because of the way that it makes me feel. And, you know, people ask me sometimes, like, because I get super amped this time of year about turkeys.
Yeah.
You know, I want to go hunt Nebraska. I want to go hunt Kansas. I'm going to hunt Colorado. I'm going to Montana. I really want to get down to Florida. I was talking about it with Derek Wolfe and Josh Walker the other day at the CBA banquet.
Yeah, yeah.
I have all of these things that I want to do. Also have no money. Problem. but turkeys are, in my opinion, little feathered elk. I called them the same way I would to an elk. But turkeys above that are, they are so much more intricate, in my opinion, because, you know, their, what does their head color mean? What does their different body positions mean? I want to know all those things, because when I go turkey hunting, this bird is in full strut. He sees my decoy. His head is completely white. And all of a sudden, he starts sprinting at me in full strut. These are all super good signs.
Sure.
I know I'm going to kill this bird if everything goes right. Turkeys, I realistically, and Henry Ferguson would probably kill me in my sleep if I said this, if I told him this. So we might want to just block him from this podcast. Hard to do. All respect to Chairman Ferguson. But I would probably take turkeys over mule deer.
Wow.
And
yeah.
That's a bold statement on my hand, because I've killed some nice mule deer in my times already.
Yeah.
And I love hunting mule deer too, but the thing about mule deer is that it's a lot of it's just spot and stalk.
Yeah.
And you know, you taking a 40-yard shot, a 50-yard shot is not uncommon. Obviously, like the buck that I killed this year, a little bit different. I was using the decoy, stalked in, shot him at 15 yards, full frontal, completely different ball game at that point.
Whoa.
But mule deer don't gobble at me. They don't say, here I come. I can't locate them. And they don't really, I mean, they'll still pin the ears back and stuff, but turkeys and elk are the most interactive animals that there are for us to hunt in North America, I believe. And that's why you see me going crazy in April and in September.
Yeah, I love that. So I like what you're saying about learning the behavior of the animal, because then that helps potentially calm the internal nerves. Like, you still might get that heartbeat, that excitement, that buck fever, as we call it, but having an understanding of what you can and cannot get away with is really everything in terms of executing that shot or not pulling the trigger.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I want to be respectful of your time, but I feel like we could talk probably for 6 days here.
definitely could.
Why don't we wrap up with a couple of questions here? One, why don't you tell me your favorite like hunting memory from last season? It sounds like that deer hunt was a big one, but I'm curious, what was the deer highlight?
The deer one was very important to me, because it was, it ended up getting first place at the CBA banquet. I had no idea.
Congrats, man. I couldn't make it this year. That's huge.
Thank you. I appreciate it. And, I wasn't even going to enter him. I was caught up with, day-to-day life and trying to figure some stuff out. And I got to give that credit of that deer and, my award and all that to Matt Jackson. Matt Jackson calls me up one day. He's like, hey, Lane, so your buck's not entered in the awards banquet yet. And I was like, oh, yeah, I know. Like, I just haven't gotten around to it. I'm not sure, blah, 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 giving him a bunch of excuses. And he's like, well, Lane, it's a heck of a buck and I'm dang proud of you, but I think you ought to get it entered. I'm going to send you the score sheet for, scores in your area. And he must've called me 3 or 4 times before I was finally like, okay, I have to get this thing done or else Matt Jackson's going to track me down and shoot me. and so I ended up doing it. And that was an awesome experience. Like, I'd never won an award for hunting before.
Nice.
That was my first award. And so that felt awesome. But I got to kill that buck with my buddy JD Hart. And there's a super cool story to that one, but it's not the one that means the most to me. Mainly because when I killed that buck, I had to jump on FaceTime and call my dad, who was in Nebraska on a hunt. My dad's he's my hunting partner. There's no one else I'd rather be in the woods with. And because he's sick for it the same way that I am.
Yeah.
A lot of people will answer each other's phone calls. We can just talk and be the other person.
Yeah.
But I would say that my elk hunt this year, which will, like I told you before, it'll be a bow hunter in June or July. But that hunt, you know, I waited, I think I used 9 points to draw that unit because I was saving through high school and college.
I'm looking now. It's a beautiful bull. Oh man.
Thank you. I appreciate it. And, you know, that was, that hunt was full of adversity and, you know, trials. We weren't really getting into elk as much as we wanted to. We were dealing with super dry conditions. And we fought through it and we ended up making it work. And, you know, there were times where tensions were high, but you know, that was, that hunt was basically, I considered it like my graduation gift from football and college and all that. And kind of like a turning of the page in my life.
Hell yeah.
And, you know, being able to share that hunt with my dad and, you know, our buddy Jace Bowserman and, you know, some of our buddies that came up and helped us along the way, that whole process was one of the coolest experiences of my life. And, you know, I was super pumped to be able to share that with my dad. And that one definitely took the cake for, you know, the best experience this year. For me.
I love that, man. Thanks for sharing that. And you mentioned this Bowhunter TV. Where can people find that? Is that bowhunter.tv? Is that a YouTube channel? Is that
so Amazon? Bowhunter TV is on the Outdoor channel and the Sportsman's channel.
Cool.
On you know, any major provider
network, yeah.
Ish, whatever. Or you can, I believe you can watch those on My Outdoor TV. That's a website online.
Cool.
And then with a subscription to that service, you can watch any hunting show ever created.
I love that.
Basically,
I'll link to that in the show notes for sure. My Outdoor TV.
Yep. And that's Bowhunter TV. So, you can watch a lot of the major hunts that we've done with Ultimate Predator, and with our stalker decoys. A lot of those, especially Dad's hunts, have been documented on Bowhunter TV. You know, whether it's bow hunting whitetails from the ground in Kansas, Iowa, Illinois, elk hunts. I've got two Colorado elk hunts on Bowhunter TV. Just turkey hunts, anything. Dad's been a part of that program for 14, 16 years, something like that.
That's awesome. Well, everybody's
on there every year.
Check that out. And I'm curious, I have two more questions for you and then I'll let you go. One,
yeah,
what percentage of, whether it's you or your pops, but what percentage of your archery kills are shooting through the decoy versus setting the decoy up 10 yards in front of you, 5 yards near you, whatever, to the side? And I ask 100. Because, oh, you're shooting always through?
Always through the decoy. And the main reason is because that's truly the way that product is designed, because If you're using it off of the bow, then you're better off just using, you know, a full concealment decoy from a different company. But the main thing about our decoys that makes them useful for a bow hunter is that you are the decoy. And so it's kind of like when you're hunting elk, you can stand completely still and they'll walk right up to you. They'll touch you. As long as you're still, they don't see you. It's the same thing with that decoy. If you strap it to a tree, they won't see it.
Ah, interesting.
And so that's one of the things about our decoys that I love the most, is because now, instead of being dead still, like, oh my gosh, they're in sight, I'm locked up. No, I'm making movements. I'm flicking the ears on my decoy, or, you know, I'm flipping the tail fan on my turkey decoy up with my bow. I want to trick their eyes. And, you know, one of the things about it is being able to draw or let down if the situation isn't correct. I mean, it allows me to do so many things and it opens up so many opportunities that you don't have without a decoy. And it's allowed me to become a more successful hunter. It's given me opportunities and encounters that no one else has been able to have.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's like we were talking about this whole time. I'm in it for the experience. That's what gets me going. That's what makes my lungs tick, my heart tick. I want a experience, and that decoy gives me that experience. And
I never even thought about the idea of concealing your draw or your letdown. Obviously, you want to, but I didn't even think about that being the benefit of the decoy. That's brilliant. Because I'll be honest with you, this year with my elk, I put a cow decoy about 10 yards in front of me. I was making a bunch of cow sounds, running all over the place, got an elk, a bull to respond. Then I started stepping on his calls. And I do think that he came into 6 feet, like literally we were like nose to nose. And I do think a part of that was one, staying absolutely still. But two, and maybe I'm wrong, there was that cow decoy and I just put the middle through it on like a branch and the wind kind of does move it a little bit. So I do think there was a little bit of comfort for that animal saying, I can continue to move forward because I see my same species in that area.
Of course. And you know, there's a video on, I believe it's on the Ultimate Predator Gear YouTube page.
Cool.
It's my elk hunt from 2020. And for elk hunters, especially Colorado, you know, that bull in particular, we called him in and I drew and let down on that bull full frontal at 30 yards three times.
That's insane.
With nothing in between us.
Yeah.
And so that's a situation where if you don't have a decoy, you don't get a shot at that bull.
Nope.
And the bull was standing at 30 yards looking at us for 5 minutes. I mean, those are opportunities. And, you know, like how often do you get to see that bull bugle at you, start peeing on himself and learning just all these different aspects of his body movements and his body language? You don't get to have those in other opportunities. But on top of that, like I won't ever take a 30 yard frontal shot on any animal, period.
Mm-hmm.
Like, because you're aiming at a spot the size of a baseball to a softball. And if that animal turns at all and your shot is off by 2 inches,
mm-hmm.
now you went from making an extremely deadly shot, because that frontal shot is deadly under 20 yards.
Yeah.
But you went from making a deadly shot to wounding an animal in a really horrific way.
Yeah.
So I'm very strict on a frontal shot. And this bull, that was all he was giving me at 30 yards. And I just wasn't going to take it. So every time that he would act like he was going to turn, I would come to full draw.
Uh-huh.
And then my dad would cow call, or he would see the movement again and he comes straight back to frontal. And so I was stuck at full draw for three minutes and 30 seconds.
Gosh.
Just drawing it, letting it down, then redrawn. And I mean, I was shaking like a leaf. My fatigue had set in. And finally, he turned enough, opened up his shoulder, and I made a good shot. He went 80, 90 yards and blood everywhere.
Sure.
Enough for a colorblind guy like me to see the blood. So that hunt in particular, if y'all are interested in seeing, you know, what that Ultimate Predator decoy can do for you, that's a huge one for elk.
That's cool.
Because that's a situation where it's an over-the-counter unit on public land, 11,800 feet, on extremely pressured bulls.
Yeah.
Where this bull, he read the script perfectly.
That's
and
huge.
It's an opportunity you do not get without a decoy.
It's and amazing.
Like you were saying, though, you don't need a decoy to kill. There's guys out there. I mean, think about what, you know, our parents, our grandparents were doing for years and years and years.
Yeah.
They didn't use a decoy. They wanted to do it, you know, the sneaky, deceptive way, you know what I mean? And that's how it's worked for hundreds, thousands of years.
Yeah.
And that's completely okay. My dad has a product and I like to help him with it. I love the opportunities that it gives me. I love the success that it gives me mm-hmm. and the ability to feed my family more efficiently. So it's just another tool in your tool belt.
100%.
That's all I can really say.
I mean, I'll vouch for it too, because this year when I killed the bull, the year prior, I was in the exact same spot and the exact same time of day. It was about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And I called into a bull to the exact same area, except he stopped. He got held up about 55 yards in some tall brush. I did not have the decoy with me. I also had a rangefinder that was a little lackluster. So I improved both of those. But this year, same spot, same location, he closed that distance. And I think my tactics had something to do with it. But I think that decoy really, I can't say it wasn't a factor, you know?
Yeah.
And it also provides a little peace of mind that I'm not just out here, quote unquote, naked, like human versus animal. I have a little bit of coverage here, and it's almost like a mobile field blind to a degree. It's not that big, but.
And you said that that bull the first year hung up at like 55, 60 yards.
Yep.
That is one of the best opportunities for that decoy to shine.
Yeah. Especially solo hunting.
Having it on your bow, if you are in sight of that bull, he's coming in and he is actively looking for the cow that's calling to him.
Mm-hmm.
He wants to scoop up that cow and bring him back to the harem. Or if it's a satellite bull, he's trying to steal her away and make a harem of his own. And so a lot of the times when bulls hang up, like they were coming in great, but they just stopped. They are at a spot where they're like, I should be able to see her right now, and I'm not seeing her, and this is a problem for me.
Yep, yep.
I'm nervous about this.
Hackles are up.
If you can show him exactly what he's intending to see, I've had him break from 60 yards and come all the way into 25.
Yep.
I mean, it's huge. Just, it gives you an opportunity where you didn't have one before.
That's all I
can say about it.
I love it. All right, we'll wrap up on this one. So I mentioned it prior to us recording, but two things. One, what I was going to say as you were talking is it's getting into, to make a football analogy, it's getting into the red zone. It's kind of living in that red zone and being in that place. And I think that for me is the big difference with rifle hunting and archery hunting. It's like where the rifle hunt kind of ends, the archery hunt begins, and it's closing that distance from 300 to 30 yards or even 100 yards to 50 yards. That's that heart-pounding red zone moment that I think we all kind of live for. With that, I'm curious if you've had over the years, whether it was tagging along or on your own hunt, an experience where you're like, I don't want to get into that experience again. Something where it was either a safety issue or just kind of like, I don't need to be on that edge of a cliff or exposed to that degree. Do you have anything that comes to mind over the years?
Well, you know, I love that red zone. That red zone, the more you can be in that red zone, the more successful you're going to be. It's going to give you more opportunities.
100%.
And, you know, there's been situations where you're talking about like situations where I don't want to be in that situation again. You know, there's been a ton of situations that made me deeply, deeply uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether it's, you know, a bear walking 10 feet through your camp, you know, the wolves we're about to get in our state.
Yep.
You know, and that's just, you know, that's not just why you're hunting. That's why you're on a camping trip, you know, a high alpine fishing trip, anything. You know, that's a new set of obstacles that we're going to have to learn how to manage. Going through a rock slide in a snowstorm, terrifying in the middle of the night. That was one of them for me that where it was a bad situation. It was my first elk that I'd ever killed. We were standing on top of the ridge, me, my dad, and my little brother, Casey. And it was a rut fest down there, second rifle, middle of October.
Yeah.
And, you know, I had never heard a bugle in October before. And I'm not sure that dad had very many either. but I mean, this was the entire canyon just blew up.
Whoa.
And the problem was, is that we had about 45 minutes to an hour to get down there, kill an elk before dark.
Mm.
And on top of that, there's a massive snowstorm rolling in. Like it's starting to drop some flakes, and dad being the reasonable, you know, the leader of this hunting party, because I'm 13 years old. And my little brother's 12.
Oh my gosh.
My dad is trying this, you know, he's in this dilemma. He's like, I'm not sure that it's safe to take them down in there in this situation. It's the last day of the hunt.
Yep.
And, you know, I am on the verge of tears. Maybe I'm crying. I don't know. We're not even going to try. And finally, dad caves because he can't handle me, you know, begging like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so we go down in there and I happen to shoot my first bull. And
hell yeah.
Right bottom of the knife. And it's one of those like dual-edged sword. Like on one hand, it's like my son just killed his first bull. I killed my first bull. You know, that is super awesome. That's an extremely important moment in a kid's life.
Mm-hmm. 13, but it's like your bar mitzvah.
We take pictures and we're gutting this bull out, and all of a sudden the snow
starts coming down.
It's here. And by the time that we get out of this canyon and back to our ATVs, we've got about 6 to 9 inches of snow on the ground.
Holy shit.
And it's midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning. And on that trip up, you know, obviously it's comforting to be around, you know, your dad, your little brother, but the GPS took us on the straightest route back to the ATV, and it brought us through not one, but two, like 100-yard-long rock slides. And they're now extremely slick and covered in snow. And, you know, like if dad breaks an ankle in there,
everyone's fine.
I mean, we're screwed. It's bad. And then, you know, even me and Casey, if we get hurt in there and, you know, you got to go across two of those, that's a situation I don't want to be in again.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a learning experience, but sometimes things like that, you can't help. So that was one of those moments in my mind that really stuck with me.
I love you sharing that, man. I think that's incredible. And it's interesting because sometimes it's a reminder, and this is kind of becoming a trope on this, is that we need to keep our head when that excitement comes up, because that excitement can lead you into a canyon or over a ridge or onto a cliff face. Or for me, I spearfish. It can lead you to deeper dives when you're at the end of your breath hold or whatever that might be. And to have that peace of mind or that situational awareness of, yes, I might be able to accomplish the next task, but this might prevent me from accomplishing my goal, which is getting home to my family safe and hopefully with food and hopefully with an elk or a fish or whatever.
Yep.
But yeah, and man, the compounding factors of a 12 and a 13-year-old, the first bull, the dad wanting to provide this experience, but also I'm sure needing to worry about you guys to a higher level than he does when you're just in the living room or whatever. Man,
use your head, follow your heart, you know, try to do the safe thing, but do not live in fear. I mean, because it's never the easy stories that I remember. It's always the ones that were extremely difficult, at times downright terrifying. Those are the ones that stick with you. Those are the ones that mean the most to you. And so be safe, try your best. But if I had the option to dive into that canyon again, I would do the exact same thing.
know
exactly what, you know, worst case scenario, you know, what do you need to do to be safe in this situation?
Like
going back, going through those rock slides, go around it.
Yeah.
I don't know. You know what I mean?
Map out a path before you go down to how you're going to get back up. So that when you come up and it's dark, you have a little bit of an idea.
If the snow is pounding so bad that, you know, you need to wait until you get daylight to safely get out of here, then, you know, having a emergency shelter in your pack, in your possibles pouch, having the ability to start a fire, you know, the ability to melt some snow and get some water.
Yeah.
You know, little things like that, just, you know, understanding how do I be safe in this situation or this situation, and go out there, have fun.
You know,
do something. Do something that scares you, because you won't ever forget it. So
I love it, Lane. Henry posted a thing a while ago, and I think it was reposting one of your posts. And on it, he said, "The future of bow hunting is bright." And I couldn't agree more, man. You are an awesome spokesman for this. I love your passion. I love that it's got this bigger family tied to it. And man, this is the first of many conversations we're gonna have, I believe. You're an awesome person, dude. I really appreciate you coming on today.
Yeah, Jake, I appreciate it. I had a lot of fun. And like you said, I think we could probably talk for hours. So,
well, I'll come down to the Springs and we'll shoot.
Heck yeah, dude. Big thing, anyone that's listening, I do want to make one special announcement type thing.
Yeah.
If you're not a member of the CBA, there's a lot of the founding fathers, it's shame on you if you don't join the CBA. It's our responsibility as bow hunters, as stewards of the land that we're hunting. We need our voice right now. And, you know, I want to thank Chairman Ferguson, Henry, I can't even imagine what, you know, he's doing right now. You know, Wes Mendez,
yep,
the battles that he has to face. And
Matt,
you know,
Jackson,
our legends,
Trevin, Matt, everybody, man.
Yeah. All of the members of our CBA that are fighting for us right now, because there are so many tremendous battles, because, you know, a podcast like this, it's all about the good stuff. You know, man, I love to hunt. And well, right now in Colorado, a lot of our passions are under direct attack. Mm. And there has never been a more important, and I hope you can hear how passionate I'm talking about this, because it is, there's nothing more important right now than joining your local, you know, associations, the guys who are actually going to go and fight this on a legislative level, definitely, on a moral level. And because we need it right now more than any other time that there's been. And a lot of these issues that they're bringing up are cyclical. They've come up before and they'll come up again after it. But right now, you know, the people that are opposing us on the other side of all of these issues are extremely well organized. They're extremely well funded, and we cannot be silent when our way of life is directly under attack. So join the CBA today, grab three buddies, force them to join. I don't care. Get that awesome CBA magazine. Come join, shoot the jamboree this summer, because it's like you were talking about earlier, Jake. You know, you grew up and you didn't really have a hunting background. Joining an organization like the CBA puts you in contact with so many bow hunters out there. You'll be bow hunter. You're in a well-connected community, and they're fighting for your rights to be able to do what we love. And we need that more than ever right now.
I couldn't have said it better, man. That's a great announcement. And it's $40 a year. I'm sure you see it all the time. I even just said it. Almost any time I go into a bow shop, I spend more than $40. So if you could do that once a year, kind of factor it into your tag price or whatever other price you need to, you're really making a difference. And we're a legit 501c3 kind of, not even kind of, absolutely geared towards preserving the hunting traditions that we have and making sure that they stay into the future for, you know, our kids one day when we eventually have them. I do also want to call out where people can find you. So on Instagram, it's lane.farris, F-A-R-R-I-S. You'll be at Pellegrino's in Colorado Springs. So go check out that archery shop if you need a tune or you want to shoot some bows or buy some gear. My Bowhunter TV, that's going to be on the Outdoors and Sportsman channel. You got myoutdoortv.com as well. And then obviously Ultimate Predator Gear. Go check out Ultimate Predator Gear. And honestly, guys, put your hands on one of these decoys. They pack up light. They are super light. They attach to your bow. You can attach it to like your forearm or your quiver or whatever you want. I hang it up in a tree in front of me when I'm solo hunting. And they got turkeys and pronghorns and deer and sheep and elk and every animal you could think of. The front side, the back side, the broad side.
If you've got any questions about any of it, you know, feel free to call the number on, you know, Ultimate Predator Gear.com's website, or reach out to me on Instagram, whatever it is, because you know it's something that I'm extremely passionate about. I'm willing to help just about anybody to be successful using the decoys or just being a successful bow hunter. So awesome,
Lane. I really appreciate it. Thanks so much, brother. Have a great day.
Yep, thanks, Jake. I appreciate it, brother.
Talk soon.